You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, and welcome to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, my guest is Kara St. Louis. Kara is a writer, teacher, activist, and speaker, hailing from the American Southwest, infused with the old spirit of the sovereign individual. She has been a journalist for Veterans Today and is the author of several books, including Consolata's Companion, about the dark side or archontic presence in our lives. The Sun Thief is a thinly fictionalized thriller about the murder of her mother, who had a top Navy security clearance, and a pilot who steals a chemtrail plane. Her recent book, written with Harold Couts Vella, is titled Dangerous Imagination, Silent Assimilation. It's a paradigm-shifting book that flings the doors open to expose the vast coordinated manipulations to control and dominate humanity. Currently, she is at work on two projects. One is the follow-up to Dangerous Imagination called The Workbook, a series of standalone episodes, and I believe the first one came out today, and the, called False History, The Great Remembering. She has a project on the Celtic hearth with Master Dowser and monolith theoretician Maria Wheatley, the daughter of novelist Dennis Wheatley. She's a regular at international conferences, with one coming up at the Basis Project in England. In late May, she embarks on a lecture tour down under. I do believe that's Australia or Oz. You can read her writings and sample chapters of her book at www.vortexcourage.me. Find her on Facebook, too. So let's welcome her to the show now. Hi, Kara. How are you?
Hi, Lance. I'm actually quite well. Are you well?
I am very well.
Good. Thanks for having me on. I know we've been talking about this for some months, and so it's actually really gratifying to finally be talking to you in California. I'm in Maine right now. I'm in the United States visiting my children. Ordinarily, I'm in London, so...
Right.
Were I in London at home, it would be 3 o'clock in the morning.
Oh my goodness.
This is actually a bit better for me because you're live.
I just have to say that I love your book. It's absolutely brilliant, and I really think everybody should read it because it's just so comprehensive, and you have left no stone unturned in terms of the last 200 years being a setup for the times that we're in now. Since we only have an hour, I'm going to let you just share a bit about how you got into this and whatever else you'd like to emphasize.
Right, so you're talking about Dangerous Imagination.
Yes,
it is a very comprehensive book. It was very much meant to be that way. I handled the social engineering aspects of what's been going on for the last, what I thought was the last few hundred years, and actually very much intentionally just narrowed the scope down to the last couple of hundred years for the purposes of that book. And Harold Couts Vella handled what you might call the scientific aspects, the chemistry involved to a certain extent, although it's quite readable. There's nothing in there that's particularly difficult to understand. And also Harold, you know, esotericist that he has been in the past, delved into what he considers to be the demonic aspects of chemtrailing. And I quite agree with him that in fact is the case. There's a lot of black magic going on in our world today. It's all around us. It's happening constantly. But, you know, it's interesting. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to do sort of a timeline for everybody. And the reason why that's important to me is that this has not been going on in my life for very long. I realized this July coming up will only be the 6th anniversary of my mother's death. So it honestly, even though we all prepare a lifetime for the tasks that we end up taking up, and we can often know when the crescendo, when we're actually sort of stepping into our own shoes in a way, you know, this is actually, I have all the pieces now, which for me is actually happening now. I have all the pieces now and I'm going to carry all of those things forward. But because there's been a lot going on, there's a lot of information to manage over the last 5 or 6 years. The best way for me to handle it is to kind of do a timeline. And also, Lance, I forget that most of the world hasn't heard my story. You know, you tell your story a few times and then you think, oh gosh, people must be getting really sick of hearing this. But the reality is that most people haven't heard my story, especially in the United States, Lance, because frankly, it's very difficult to get information out in the States. In the English-speaking world, there's a lot of work being done in the non-English-speaking world that we're not aware of. We're not allowed to know about it. And I actually had to leave the United States and move to London to be able to get my voice heard in the English-speaking world at all. My theory, and I think it came from a good friend of mine, I think it's absolutely correct, is that when I'm in London, I'm actually at the center of one of the webs. And information coming out from London is not impeded in any way. In fact, it's on full throttle all the time.
Huh.
This is the financial spider web, you know?
Right,
and
right.
So I can piggyback on these sort of unimpeded outward flow that the parasites want to be coming from London. So you know, it was, I actually had to leave my own country in order to make my voice heard. As you did mention, I'm finally 4 years into this project, getting a foot in the door in Australia. It's been even harder to get myself heard in Australia. So I'm feeling very, very excited and happy about that starting. I believe I'm speaking on May 31st in Melbourne, which appears to be the cutting edge city, strangely enough, in Australia. There's not a lot of people doing alternative shows like you're doing there at all. And I know I'll be speaking in Byron Bay, and there's a really good chance I'll be at Paracon in Sydney. But that will be prior to May 31st. I'll let you know if that, I think that that's what's going to happen. I'm just trying to take advantage of the fact I'm only down there for 8 or 9 days. And I'm doing 3 or 4 lectures across the country.
Oh, wonderful.
But you've got to make hay while the sun shines, Lance. You've got to do
it.
If you get in there and you get people's attention, you just have to keep talking. So let me begin. At the beginning for me is July 10th, July 11th, 2010. July 11th, 2010, 7/11 is one of those dates. It's very important. Anybody who's into esoterics out there will realize that I just uttered a very important number, 7/11. Mm-hmm. That was the day that my mother, who had been working for the Naval Office of Naval Research at that time and had been working for the military for some time and had a fairly high security clearance, but at that point was 74 years old. She was definitely in the twilight of her lifespan. And she'd come to Maine to be near us. She'd come to Maine to be near her grandchildren because she knew they were graduating, getting ready to leave. And she was walking to church one Sunday morning, and it was a beautiful day here in Maine. And many cars had stopped. She was crossing Main Street, and she had just about gotten to the other side when a van came hurling down the street and crashed into her and threw her, got dozens and dozens of yards, and pretty much broke every bone in her body. And she died a few hours later with me in the room, as it should be, right by her side. And as I went through the following year, it was a huge grieving process, as I'm sure you can imagine, an ongoing grieving process. Obviously, this is a horrific thing to have happen. Mm-hmm. And but this thing that never left me, this thing that would not leave me alone, and she knew bloody well it wouldn't leave me alone, was the idea that it had not been an accident.
Right.
Because it just didn't make any sense, Lance. It didn't make any sense. These kinds of things just do not happen in tiny little towns, out of the way for no reason, a woman like herself, who had been working, by the way, with Operation Paperclip scientists in London, and had, oh yes, absolutely.
I met several of them. The explanation.
Yes, these were the people who were working on atmospheric physics. electromagnetic weapons, psychology-driven weapons. These were not small potatoes people. And she was responsible at that point for collating all of the information, summarizing their work in a way, and making it not just understandable to other scientists around the world, but available to other scientists around the world. Mm. So this publication that she worked on is called The Fact Sheet. And I have to say, just as an aside, it was really difficult for me to get access to her work for a while when I first started looking into this. But as I started to talk about her work and as the years went by, you know, the Navy in its sly smartness decided to gather up all of her work and publish it under her name. And you can actually buy those fact sheets now. I don't know that they're original fact sheets. They may be whitewashed. They're certainly selling them for a huge amount of money. I have absolutely no idea why they would do that. But the reality is, this is an old technique. You know, I'm talking about it. They gather it all up. They control it themselves. They price it really high. Mm-hmm. You know, and but it's out there if somebody wants to get a hold of it. Anyway.
Right.
So here I am, and a few things happened to me during that year that were the kinds of things that you would expect to happen if you have been following, you know, our activism or reading thrillers, really. Brakes going out in the car, people trying to run you off the road into oncoming traffic, you know, the standard stuff, right? The standard stuff. And so it didn't really do much to convince me that I was imagining things when, you know, I had this gut feeling that this had not been an accident. And in fact, one of the people I talked to not too long after this happened, who actually was the first person to get my story out in print in the United States, was Gordon Duff. Now, I realize Gordon's having problems of his own these days. Veterans today is having problems of their own these days.
Right.
The reality is he published my commentaries on my book. He was the first one to do so. He said, VT's not afraid of this story.
And he also
assured me that civilians dying in the military is very commonplace.
They're expendable. Yep.
You know, they're considered to be loose ends. This is not unusual. He said it happens a whole lot more than you might think. So there were those things going on. I could not get a police report about my mother's death, even though I was the sole survivor, and it seemed like a cut and dried incident. I had to have an attorney send a letter to the local cop shop reminding them of the Freedom of Information Act, which really, in the end, wouldn't have applied. But you know, you have to do what you can do. You know, then about November of that year, I got this letter in the mail that actually had no return address and was hand addressed, and it was a copy of a very cursory police report from the accident. So somebody was trying to get me some kind of information, but I still to this day have no idea who sent me that. You know, hand address with no return address. These things just add up. And, you know, I didn't have any proof that it was deliberate, and I still don't have any proof that it was deliberate, no smoking gun, but I have a mountain of circumstantial evidence, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it was long about the end of that year, 2010, December 31st, 2010, what was his name in D.C. who was killed? John Wheeler. John Wheeler was found in a dumpster, if you guys remember that story. He was an advisor to three presidents. He was the man who got the Vietnam Memorial erected.
Oh, yeah.
He was, you remember him?
Yeah.
He was a West Point graduate, superb credentials, a liaison between all kinds of companies trying to do business with the Pentagon.
Yep.
And he showed up in a dumpster one day. And I thought, you know, I didn't think that my mother knew him, but I did. That reminded me so much of what had happened to her. For absolutely, you know, you just couldn't fathom how this could happen. So that started me thinking about it again. And then it was the next day, Lance, January 1st, when the birds started falling from the sky in Arkansas by the tens of thousands.
I remember that.
The very next day. And the fish started washing up on the sea. And we started to realize that animals were dying by the tens of thousands for no explicable reason whatsoever. And Arkansas was trying to float this idiotic theory that it was firecrackers, remember?
Oh, yes,
and,
I do.
necropsies on those birds. Necropsies on those birds determined that it wasn't a single external injury on any of them, but all of their internal organs had exploded,
mm-hmm.
and they had bled to death. Now this, I'm sorry, but this is electromagnetic weaponry. This is microwave weaponry.
Yep.
This is a new form of, this is an experiment.
Yep.
This is an experiment to see what you can do and how much impact you can have. And of course, the military being who they are, you know, they're going to do it on animals. And that's going on to this day, by the way. It mm-hmm. is going on globally, daily, and we're just not necessarily hearing about it. So it was at that point I decided to go ahead and write a book. Mm-hmm. Now, this is something else that my mother would have known that I was going to do. Absolutely mm-hmm. would have known. She and I maintain to this day that she and I came here to do this, that she and I came to this planet as a code and decoder ring in the same cereal box.
Oh.
My mother was a very specific kind of person. My mother was someone who sort of was written upon, if that makes any sense. She went through her life sort of accumulating experiences, but mm-hmm. not necessarily evaluating them. And
right.
I think that's what she was meant to do.
Right.
And because my mother was like that, I became a hyper aware person.
Uh-huh.
And I'm empathetic and I'm clairvoyant and all of those things. And she knew that I would, she knew damn well I would write about that. I would figure this out and I would write about it. And I did. And there are a million things in that book that took me years to figure out that they were even in there, because I'd never heard of some of these things. What I wanted to do to begin with was try to figure out, make some sense of what had happened. Number one, by the way, the guy that ran her over, they ended up dismissing the charges, even though he pled guilty to manslaughter, even though the only thing left was sentencing. Okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In the end, he did not serve any time and they dropped the case. Okay.
Right.
Now that tells you something, doesn't it?
Yep.
Yep. Okay.
Standard MO.
Yeah. So the two things I needed to do with this book was kind of for myself. I needed to figure out what had happened, if at all possible. So I went back to the points in time in our past. Everything that's in there, it's fictionalized for sure, because I wanted people to want to read it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I wanted to tell a story. It's what I do anyway. But every conversation between the woman and her mother is word for word. It's all verbatim, you know, and my family is in there, and that's all verbatim. But the other thing I decided to try to do once I started opening up this world, which ended up being chemtrails and ended up being geoengineering, magnetic weapons, the Air Force wanting to own the weather by 2025, you know the trail. It's the trail we all take, and it's all out there for everybody
right.
to grab. It's just right in your face, and it has to be right in your face because, you know, I've always said they have to park the truth somewhere. You can't make the lie work. The spell does not work unless they tell you what they're doing. It's just a law of black magic, okay?
Yeah.
Now, so the other thing I did was invent a character. Although my friend, my ex-writing partner, Harold Kautzgala, says we don't write fiction, and I quite believe him on that, but there is a character in there that was a pilot, a chemtrail pilot, who does something to try to take evidence somewhere where people can see the evidence of what's going on, and that's actually the thriller part of the book, and it makes it intensely readable, number one. And number two, you get all kinds of technical information within the context of his part of the story. And I also have to say, do you know Mark McCandless? You might, because you're in California.
Mm-hmm.
You heard of a fellow called Mark McCandless?
Which, say that again?
Have you heard of a man called Mark McCandless?
Mark McCandless.
McCandless. Well, you need to look up his work if you haven't come across it yet, because no one in the world has more technical data or more inside information about skunk works and state-of-the-art materials, aviation materials, than Mark. And he's one of the people I was listening to when I first started looking into this. And I just decided one day to give him sent him an email and asked him if he wouldn't mind looking over the aviation portions of my book, because I am not an aviator and I'm not a scientist, and I didn't want someone to throw the book across the room because they were, and they went, oh, this is ridiculous, you know? He very kindly offered to be my tech advisor on the book, and he did that month after month with no pay or any of that. He just volunteered to do it. So I have to say, without this guy, Mark McCandless, he lives in Reading, I think, the Sun Thief wouldn't exist. It simply would not exist. So I always have to mention Mark when I say things like this. He's also an expert on UFOs. He's an experiencer. So he's worth talking to if you ever come across him. Anyway, so Mark helps him with the aviation.
Hmm? How do you spell his last name?
M-C and then capital C.
Okay.
A-N-D-L-I-S-H.
Okay.
And he's on Facebook, okay?
Okay. Got
all right,
it.
And he's a great he's really a great interview. He's the one he's the guy I started listening to begin with. He taught me more about he was my primer for chemtrails and for aluminum nanoparticle infiltration of the body and biologically what that does to us and all that kind of stuff.
Ah.
And then I realized that he knows more about state-of-the-art skunkworks materials aviation than anybody I've ever met. Anyway, so thanks to Mark, because the Sun Thief exists because of Mark. Anyway, the day that book was finished, the day that book was done, was March 31st, 2012, okay? And at midnight, between March 31st and April 1st, my house burned down. So that was the very last thing.
That's happened to other people I know.
Yeah. So my oldest son was at college. My daughter was spending the night with someone else, thankfully. My youngest son had a friend, and they were actually on the floor where the fire started. But my ex-husband went up there and realized that there was a fire, got everybody out. We got the dogs out. We got the cats out. And I ran back into the building and got my thumb drive out of my computer that had my book on it, thankfully. So these are the kinds of things that happened to me while I was writing that book and trying to get that book out. And I consider those to be evidence that I certainly was on the right track about something, okay? As I went along and I promoted the book, and the book got translated into German, this is how I met Harold Kautzwelle. And I ended up moving to London and started getting some attention for this story. People in Germany were interviewing me. The book was translated by Harold, as I said. And so that's how I met Harold. And we ended up doing some lectures together. One of the times that we were lecturing in Germany, I said, Harold, you know, I just have this feeling we're supposed to do something together. We need to write a book together. And he was working on sentient oil at that time. He was working on black goo. I was working for David Icke. I had gone from being a mom in Maine, minding my own business, raising my children. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was a writer. I was a writer, but I mean, essentially I was raising my children, you know, to living in London and being a producer at the People's Voice TV for David Icke in a very short period of time, Lance, a very short period of time. Yeah. And so it was during an interview that I was being interviewed by Richie Allen on that show. That interview is still available. Any of these interviews is available. If you Google Kara St. Louis, you'll find all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized as he was interviewing me and he was asking me the same two questions that people always ask me that you have not asked me. Thank you very much. You're a smart man, Lance. But the two questions they always asked at the time was, what's the difference between a contrail and a chemtrail?
Oh, please. Oh,
so
God.
Tired of answering that freaking question.
Yeah.
The answer to that question is so simple, so easy. We should all be way past that one by now. And
yeah,
then the other thing was, he said, Kara, you know, the thing that they always say to me is there too many people would have to know this is going on for it to be going on.
Right.
And I looked at him as he was, I mean, you know, sometimes you just have these moments of clarity, Lance. And I looked at him, I thought, that's it. That is the hamster wheel. that we are on right now.
Right.
And we are on many, many, many hamster wheels, and they are set up to keep our brains going in the circular, you know, reasoning and circular arguments so that we never figure out.
Yep.
You know, we never can move beyond that stuff.
Yeah.
And so at that period of time, I decided that I really needed to know why we couldn't move beyond those kinds of questions. And that's what the book became. Dangerous Imagination, Silent Assimilation became that. And that was just opening another Pandora's box, you know?
Yeah.
Which is what's been going on for all of us, not just me, for you and everybody else. And what I have made a commitment to doing is being the translator between the things that I'm finding and the broadest possible audience.
Right.
Which means I have to, you know, there's a very specific kind of writing that is. And so anyway, the first thing that I came across, of course, was the education system. One does, you know,
right.
The Prussian education system, which was essentially a result of what had happened in 1805. Believe it or not, there are two things, and one of them did not make it into that book. It made it into my latest book because, it was new research, but to put together. But in 1805, Frederick of Prussia, which is an artificial construct, by the way, Prussia is a collection of probably, you know, somewhere between 50 and 150 of the most beautiful little German principalities that ever existed that were collected up artificially by the Teutonic Knights, as they were ordered to do so by the Knights Templar in the Middle East, and slapped together and named Prussia. And Prussia became a military bug force, a mercenary force, really, in Germany. It hasn't got a whole lot to do with what Germany really is in its heart and soul. However, the Prussian emperor, Wilhelm II, lost a battle to Napoleon at Jena in 1805. And that was quite the blow to Prussia because, I mean, you know, you just, this is something that you just did not do. You were more likely in the Prussian army to die at the hands of a superior, your superior officer, than you were at the hands of an enemy. It was brutal. It was an absolutely brutal gang of mercenaries that just couldn't be beat. So, and Napoleon's army has been described as a group of amateurs, you know, and somehow, some way they managed to beat them. So Wilhelm had a fit, an absolute meltdown. Obviously, this couldn't happen. And this whole sort of construct was bent toward trying to figure out how to create a citizenry that would not leave the front line, that would not go home and try to save their own skin, that would, in fact, die for their country or die for their sovereign. Now, does that sound familiar?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we're all living under that still in the United States for sure and all over the world.
No kidding.
The thing that happened was by 1818, they actually had devised or rekindled this education system that was really nothing more than an institution for social brainwashing, really. They could tell as they could take the children. It wasn't, at that point, wasn't much of a problem unless you happened to be a male living in Prussia, but that was going to change. You know, they lined you up in desks and they told you exactly what they wanted you to hear, and they took you away from your family far too young and far too vulnerable. And literally, Johann Fichte, who wrote Address to the German People at that time, at the behest of the powers that be, had said the German, German parents obviously can't be trusted with their children anymore. So, I mean, we have Hillary Clinton saying that kind of stuff now, you know.
She says
the job of the government to raise your children, and the parents are really secondary. In loco parentis, I mean, that's what we're in. And there's no, you know, it only takes two or three generations to eliminate memories on the surface. Not underneath, but on the surface. And they're still, and they are working on eliminating memories, you know, at every level. But we can talk about that in a little while. The thing I had not factored in, though, Lance, that I really want to add is that at the same time or thereabouts, there was a pope, Pope Clement, and I think it was the 13th. Someone will correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure. who had decided that the Jesuits were absolutely too dangerous to exist, and so had them disbanded and banished from two countries that weren't particularly Catholic. And it was in 1815 or so when Pope Pius X was released from a Napoleonic jail that the Jesuits were reformed with a vengeance. And we all know how Jesuits are involved in education. So I had missed that in Dangerous Imaginations, and so I want to bring that because it was in 1818 that the Prussian education system was rolled out. And you can bet your bottom dollar that the Jesuits had a big hand in that. Mm-hmm. Because it's been their, you know, the reason for existence to control every level of society and every level of power. So the first thing I had to talk about was the education system. The second thing I came across were the social engineering aspects of the 20th century. And then you have to talk about sort of two arms of the octopus. And one of them is the Tavistock Institute, and the other one is the Frankfurt School. And both of those things still exist today. The Tavistock Institute has more than 3,000 arms worldwide. You don't know what you're dealing with when you're dealing with them. The Tavistock Institute, there is a section of that entity that has chosen every U.S. president since Woodrow Wilson and every Secretary of State since that era as well. And it's really the Secretary of State who takes orders from the tabby at that level. And they run the country. The Frankfurt School was actually a collection of people, and I have to say it, they were all Jewish, because that's just what it was. Mm-hmm. And they came together in Germany at the University of Frankfurt. It really didn't have anything to do with Frankfurt other than that they were housed at the University of Frankfurt. These were people who were failed Bolsheviks. Bolshevik Revolution had not worked in Russia. They had not counted on the Russian folk soul. And this is often what the parasite does not count on, is the folk soul. The folk soul lives in the morphogenic field and really cannot be destroyed. And they didn't turn on themselves the way the Bolsheviks expected them to do, regardless of how brutal the Bolshevik regime had been. So this failed, you know, Bolshevik experiment went away. And began looking for a means of expression. The Tavistock Institute bent their will toward attacking the divine feminine. Mm-hmm. And in this case, in 1905, 1910, 1915, became an attack on the mother. It became an attack on this idea that raising your children was the highest thing you could aspire to. It became the lowest thing you can aspire to. It became degrading. It became, do you know, we all went through that with the feminist stuff when it became something that you had to be ashamed of wanting to do. And then the Frankfurt School went after the divine masculine. And I have to tell you, Lance, that it was a very long time before I could talk about the quote-unquote divine masculine without looking over my shoulder in a way, because I was raised in the 50s and 60s and 70s in the United States, and we were taught that the male was at the bottom of every ill, evil problem. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah, me too.
And to talk about a divine masculine, I mean, this was, you know, this was programmed into us not to do that. But the divine feminine and the divine masculine were under massive attack during the early part of the 20th century and remain so, although I don't know how you feel about it, but I see massive signs of pushback on both of those. Certainly the divine feminine has made itself felt in a big, big way since the Venus return in 2012. And I find a real reaching out, a real hand out to this idea of the divine masculine to pull it up to its feet, have it stand by our side, you know, and take its place, its rightful place as the partner, you know,
right,
of humanity. I really think that that's what's going on, and that excites me. That makes my heart really warm. But listen, while I'm thinking about it, before we get too far into dangerous imagination, I have to tell you that when I was working with Ike, and right after I'd had this interview with Richie, I realized that in the book, I had had a vision, and I'd written down every vision I'd ever had. You know, I'd just written down everything because I knew it was coming from my mom. And in this book, there was a vision that I'd written down, and she was sitting in an employee's lounge of some sort at a job. And, you know, based on the way it looks in my mind, I would have to say it was probably Virginia when she was working at Naval Surface Weapons in Virginia, which is after London. And she had a piece of, you know, a yellow legal pad in front of her, right? Uh-huh. And somehow I couldn't see what was on it. It looked like a letter, and across the top was written "top secret." I don't know what it was, but that's the only thing I could make out. And then she was chewing on a Brock's Caramel, which is something she never did because she had a lot of bridge work. Uh-huh. And she was smoking a cigarette, which is something else she never did because she was a singer. She'd gotten through school on a music scholarship. There was no way my mother was going to be smoking a cigarette, but she had both of those things going on. And then she said, "I tried to stop them." I still don't know what that means in any way, shape, or form, okay? But that is what she said. Huh. And then as she said that, down the walls, Lance, came this viscous kind of greenish fluid, okay?
Wow.
And it came up through the sink, and it came, you know, just before it sort of started to flow over the whole room.
Ooh.
And up through the sink, and yeah, it wasn't too long. The reason that pulled me up short is because I had just seen David Griffin talk about black goo, sentient oil, on bases. And one of the things, as I was looking at this stuff that was flowing down the wall, the only thing I could think of to describe it at that time was it looked like antifreeze, you know? It was kind of clear but not clear, and it was kind of viscous at that level, and then I saw this thing by David that David Griffin had put out, and he said that the code name for black goo when it is at active temperature is antifreeze.
Oh.
So, yeah. So I realized that my mother had written about black goo in that book, or she had had me write about black goo in that book. At that time, I was standing in the offices of the People's Voice, and there was really no one around to talk to that I didn't think was going to call me, you know, a lunatic, except for Ike. So I grabbed David and I said, "Okay, come here. I got to tell you something." We went into his office and I said, I just have to say this to someone who's not going to think I'm a lunatic.
Uh-huh.
And so I told him what I had just realized, and, you know, he listened to me and everything, and didn't have a whole lot to offer other than the fact that he felt like that he certainly believed that sentient oil was possible. But I mean, I just think before I moved along, I wanted to say that because it illustrates the levels of what's in these books that I'm receiving and putting in, and they keep revealing themselves level after level after level after level.
Oh, it just keeps going on. And you know, we're told in advance usually through science fiction, about these things decades before they come out. For instance, when you mentioned the black goo, the first time I heard about it through Harold, I remembered that the X-Files had numerous episodes on this subject, and at the time I thought, that just resonates. You know, the black goo was, and, you know, people can reference it. And then on The Outer Limits, they had an episode that was a woman vacuuming, and it presages smart dust. This dust gets picked up in the vacuum, and it becomes an entity. Well, guess what? DARPA has smart dust. They tell us.
They do.
Yeah. So, go on. So you told David about it.
Yes, I told David. Anyway, I just wanted to mention that because I want, you know, this idea of all of the levels, you know, of things that are coming into these books to be out there. So anyway, Dangerous Imagination ends up being about all of these things. It ends up being about a bit about the media. I'm going to cover that more extensively in the next series of books. One of the things that So we can actually move on. It's interesting, as I was saying to Lance, I've just put out what I've done with Dangerous Imagination, Silent Assimilation, is I've decided to make it a trilogy. The first book is out. Yep. The first book is out. Harold and I wrote the first book. It's a crackerjack book. It's a no excuses book. It's the why and the what. You need to read it. I'm telling you, you just need to read it. All right. The second book I call the workbook, Dangerous Imagination, Silent Assimilation Workbook. In the end, that book's probably going to run about 600 pages.
Wow.
Now, it is a workbook, and it's an interesting phenomenon what's going on with this thing, because what I've done, there's a fellow in Australia, well, so he runs Nexus Magazine. His name's Duncan
Rhodes.
Oh,
yeah, Nexus,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and he told me I should serialize the first one. I didn't want to do that because I wanted both of those pieces to go together. That was the whole point, you know?
Uh-huh.
But in this case, I think he's right, because each bit of this book runs 50 or 60 pages. Each is kind of a standalone chapter. I'm calling them episodes, and I'm calling them episodes because episode is actually a literary term, okay?
Uh-huh.
It's been stolen by, you know, the idiot box, by television. I'm taking it back, and I've just put out the first episode. This is where my research has led me to this place. It's called False History, The Great Remembering. Everything that I have come across in the last couple of years, but particularly the last year and a half, truly indicates that, you know, there's a biological there's an organic hologram and there's an inorganic hologram.
Right.
We as human beings use our imagination as the interface. We are very powerful beings in the universe, and we use our imagination to interface between the morphogenic field and what is materialized on this plane. That is what we do. That is how we are unique. That is why everybody wants to control our imagination, okay?
Mm-hmm.
For the parasite, mm-hmm. the predator, however you want to look at that, interdimensional, intradimensional entities. It's all about getting control of or eliminating somehow the human imagination, because we are co-creators. We bring the organic hologram. There's also an inorganic hologram. That appears to be coming from an inorganic source, perhaps an AI source. Certainly that's what Harold thought. I think that's what Miles Johnston thinks, and I think that they're probably correct in that there is an artificial intelligence working a bipolar, working a duality.
Oh, I agree.
But we are polar entities. We're polar entities, and that's the healthy part of who we are. Male and female is not a duality. It's a polarity. Life
right,
and death is a
right.
polarity. It's not a duality. The duality is AI. It's binary. And we are not a binary entity. We are not. We are all the numbers, Lance. We
yes.
are all the numbers from 1 to infinity, but particularly 1 to 12. We should still be on a 12 number system, for example. 12 is a brilliant, 12 is everything. Think about 12 and 360 and, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
36 and 48 and all of those things. That is what creation is about. Creation is really about 12. Now, what this entity, this inorganic, can't create anything but would love to be able to do so, and keeps creating dead things like, you know, trees that don't harbor life and computers that are really poor replicas of human brains and
uh-huh.
all of those things, cloning,
yep.
spiritless
yep.
life, those sorts of things. They would like to cut us off at 2. And
oh, yeah.
that's where they are. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. So we really need to keep the 3s, the 4s, the 5s, which is where it starts getting geometric and very, very spiritual. You know, all of these numbers, we are all the numbers, and they want to cut it, you know, they try to cut us off at 2. Anyway, where was I going? Oh, the new, okay. What I have discovered is that there's, you know, it's funny because you know how synchronicity means that lots of us are discovering the same thing at the same time?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how you know you're on the right track. There's a false chronology. There's a false chronology in play as well. It has been going on since the mid-16th century. It was the chronology, meaning the timeline that we operate on right now as modern human beings, was actually devised by a couple of Jesuits with some big help by Benedictine monks in the 16th century. It is absolutely patently false. The chronology, meaning our timeline, has been a construct with an inserted period of time of up to, well, for sure, at least three periods, one of 1,000 years, one of 300 years, and I can't remember what the other one was, 750 or 800 years. These are inserted periods of time, and since they have us hostages in school, they can tell us any damn thing they want to tell us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they were primarily inserted to justify the dynasties that are in place around the world that have no real reason to be ruling us, you know. And many people will say that most people will say that all of the dynasties go back to the same bloodlines for sure. But chances are that you could trace them all back to that artificial Prussian construct.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I've discovered are there are a couple of amazing researchers working right now. Some of the things that I bring are primary research, Lance. Mm-hmm. Lots of the things I bring are my own research of gathering up other people's work. And I always make sure that I credit other people with their work when I bring it together. There's a woman called Sylvia Ivanova who's doing really, really good work out of Austria. She has a video series called New Earth. One word, she uses that as one word, N-E-W-E-A-R-T-H.
Okay.
New Earth. The 42-bit, the new book, this particular episode is me trying to summarize roughly 2,000 pages of research and 42 videos. Okay.
Wow.
And what
wow.
I'm trying to do is present a little package. It is the workbook. So I'm presenting a little package with lots and lots of details that hopefully make sense and lots of paths that people can follow on their own.
Nice.
That's come out in the last couple of days as the first episode. The other researcher, aside from Sylvia Ivanova, is a Russian researcher called Anatoly Fomenko. That's F as in Frank, O-M. As in mother, E-N as in nut, K-O, Anatoly Fomenko. He is one of the most highly respected, top-notch mathematicians and astronomers in Russia. Lots of things are coming out of Russia and Germany these days, and I'm just very lucky. My husband is German. He translates a lot of this for me, so I know what's going on. Because I promise you that English speakers aren't allowed to know most of this. The United States is an electromagnetic prison camp. We don't know nothing, my friend. And once I left the United States, I realized how much nothing we know. We're not allowed to know. And
you're right.
This particular item, this chronology, has some very aggressive foes out there. And began, by the way, with Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton was a chronologist. Most people don't know that. And he tried and tried and tried to get this down on paper and publish something about this. The erroneous nature of the chronology, but only a year before his death. Oswald Spengler knew about it. I mean, all kinds of historians know that the chronology is dead wrong and that we are being led down the garden path for nefarious purposes, for the purposes of the parasites, getting power, keeping power, and staying in power. And I think, Lance, that it's really, really important that we get this word out now using the very same technology that they are racing to use to shut those holes. So we never know that none of this is true, that the hologram is really that complete. It's really that deep, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there are probably 100 scientists, top-notch mathematicians and astronomers working on this as part of a team in Russia trying to reconstruct the real chronology for the last several hundred years to the very best of their ability. Now, as I said, my research for this particular episode was an encapsulation of about 2,000 pages. That's not all. There's a series of 7 books that Fomenko has put together with his partners, with his fellow researchers.
Mm-hmm.
4 of them you can still get in print, although that number 4 is kind of hard to get now. The rest are on Kindle, I suggest to everybody that right after you buy my new book, that's shameless promotion there, that you try to get a hold of these other books and safeguard them, because they will start to disappear.
Right, right.
All of this information will start to disappear, and we have to have our hands on it. Kindle's groovy. Kindle's lovely. Kindle's great, but Kindle is supremely manipulable.
Oh yeah.
By whoever's putting it out, can be changed anytime. I've had to struggle getting my books out, for example, in Australia, New Zealand, places like that, where Amazon wants to put them on Kindle and won't put them in print. And
well,
I'm still struggling
Amazon
to figure out.
Well, you know, Amazon is Google now, right?
Huh?
You know that Amazon is owned by Google.
Yeah, you know, you can't even untangle these webs anymore. I mean, this is what I think a lot of us are saying right now. There's no point in trying to untangle. It's just time to hit the reset button.
Right.
Just get rid of it. Just walk away. Put the toys down, throw your TV out the window, and walk away from all of it, and just start over and see what's there, you know? And by the way, most of my lectures I have to start now by saying I'm not going to argue the flat earth theory, the tosses
right.
on the flat earth theory. I'm not going to, but I will say to you that isn't it an interesting coincidence that just as all of this stuff is getting up ahead of steam, with most of the proof for the chronology coming from standard classic astronomy, spherical astronomy, all of a sudden we've got this flat earth theory and we're getting pushed back down to two dimensions, and it calls into question the very basic astronomy that we've always used mathematically to prove the passage of time. Because there are things that are absolutely, you know, dependable, and those sorts of things would be eclipses and patterns of the moon and patterns that, you know, the way the planets travel and comets that come and go and things like that. And one of the things, okay, let me just give you a couple of examples from this episode. It's very clear that Rome, for example, is not very far behind us. It's not nearly as far behind us as we think it is, or as we've been told it is, right?
Uh-huh.
And that they're in the non-English speaking countries of the world, there is clear and well-known evidence that Nero, Caesar, uh-huh. was making agreements with Habsburg princes. And that those medieval princes actually attended gladiator contests. We don't know it in the English-speaking world because we're not allowed to see these things, but it's been pretty well known there for forever.
Huh.
Okay,
wow.
So there's not much time between us and Rome at all.
Interesting.
Okay, that's where that 1,000 years gets stuck in and phantom dynasties start to appear, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is that if you follow cosmologically, astronomically, the eclipses and shooting stars and comets and things like that, if in fact Jesus Christ did exist, he was a medieval character. He was absolutely a medieval character, a 12th century character.
Huh.
And also, did you realize that the Catholic Church has been celebrating the appearance of the Archangel Gabriel to Mary for 600 or more years as having happened in Loreto, Italy? In Italy.
Wow.
And they celebrate that every year.
You know, we're going to, I just want to give you a little time alert.
Oh, yeah, I see.
That we're going to be coming down to the last few minutes of the show, and I
want
to make sure that you have enough time to wrap it up adequately. And I wanted to ask you a question about Nemesis,
yes.
or Planet X, but I think we'll have to save that for the next episode.
Okay. Yeah, we have, as you can see, there's lots to talk about.
Oh,
my
gosh.
The next chapter, the next episode, I know what I can say to you, actually. And, Lance, we could talk anytime you want to. That's perfectly enjoyable and perfectly wonderful. If you want to do this, a few more of these, that's fine. The next episode is going to be on what I consider to be, there is absolute research coming out of Germany. That two things. First of all, there's I've identified myself as part of the Fae bloodline, P-H-E or F-E-Y or however you want to spell that.
Uh-huh.
And I've been looking into that for quite some time. This is something else that's happened to me in the last couple of years. There's evidence, big evidence, coming out of Germany. That planet has been located. It's called Fechda, P-H-E-C-D-A, and it is part of the Big Dipper. It is part of the Big Dipper in a circumpolar constellation, which is not part of Ursa Major. People think it is, but it's in front of Ursa Major. Anyway, it circumnavigates the poles. That evidence, as though that particular interstellar traveler being our original seeder, and how that goes back to both the Battle of the Boyne and an even older Irish battle called the Battle of Moytura. That's the second episode in this new book, this workbook. I will also be looking into savior programming.
Oh,
because
yeah.
Because that's another way they get us. There's all kinds of examples of that, but one of the most recent examples of that is Kesh. You know, if you're looking at Kesh's work, Kesh is nothing in my research. I'm probably going to make people mad, but he's a snake oil salesman. And he says he's a messiah. He gives series of lectures he calls teachings, and that's coming in under massive question right now. But no matter who people like this are, this falls under the conditioning we call savior programming. My ex-writing partner fell to this. My ex-writing partner decided that Jesus the Christ had been reborn. He was 2 years old, and that there were people that he was speaking to, interdimensional characters he was speaking to, who were going to save us as long as we admitted that evil had won.
So the
savior programming is very dangerous, and it can get all of us. So anyway, I know we're running out of time. There's tons to talk about. I hope we can talk again soon, Lance.
After the show, we'll set up the next interview, because I have some open slots, and you really are on the cutting edge, because you've just gone, you know, completely out of the rabbit hole and out of the envelope. So I'd be delighted to have you back, and, you know, this is kind of like an appetizer for everybody. We'll dig into the main course and start, you know, dissecting the meal as we go.
Right.
So, yes.
Right. And there's a million things we need to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and before we have to actually sign off, I want you to mention your website and where people can find you.
Okay. Please look me up, first of all, on Facebook, Kara St. Louis Authors page. I do a lot of business there. I've just set up a discussion page for False Histories, The Great Remembering, which is the episode I was just talking about, for people to, because it's eliciting a tremendous amount of discussion, as I'm sure you can imagine already.
Oh, yeah.
And I also have an online magazine. It's called Vortex. And it, as Lance has already said, it's www.vortexcourage.me. VORTEXCOURAGE.ME. Go to Amazon, type my name in, pull up the books. There's a lot of work to do. We have a lot of work to do, and we are ahead of the game right now, but we have to stay ahead of the game.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah.
I post your articles on Facebook myself, so if people want to friend me, Zany Mystic is actually Lance White on Facebook. And I'm easy to find, and I have a group there that has over 6,000 people on it that's about galactic history. But
yes.
I post all of your articles, Kara, because you're right on the front. So, and I'm in touch with a lot of people after doing this for 10 years, so I try to get, you know, people that are cutting down to the core and getting the best information. And you are definitely...
Well, you know what? We just have to decide that you know what, Lance? I just don't care what anybody thinks
I'm
saying.
I don't either.
I don't care.
I don't care.
I have 3 children, and this is not the world that I want to leave them.
Exactly.
So I no longer care what anybody thinks about what I'm saying.
Exactly.
This has got to stop.
Well, Kara, we have to sign off, so I just want to thank you profusely, and we'll have you back really, really soon. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Lance. Good to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.